Few people live in Colwyn Borough, and it appears even fewer have been keeping tabs on its public officials. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Pennsylvania lists 28 distressed municipalities, a status bestowed on those with problems delivering services or paying bills. In Colwyn Borough, the newest member of that group, the single biggest problem is corruption. WHYY's Laura Benshoff has this story from Delaware County.
Next stop, 65th and Woodland for Route 108.
Take the number 11 trolley southwest out of Philadelphia, and the first stops will land you next to Colwyn, a borough covering less than half a square mile in Delaware County. Colwyn is so small, it sometimes doesn't register on official documents. Aisha Jackson moved to the borough 3 months ago from southwest Philadelphia. She said when she tried to get her ID changed to reflect her new address, the DMV didn't recognize it.
They're like, no, the address is now found. I'm like, I've been living in Colwyn for how many months now?
Darby is a neighboring township. Jackson is hanging out on her friend Jessica Campbell's stoop. Both are Liberian immigrants who left Philly for somewhere they feel is quieter and safer. Wave after wave of people have left Philadelphia for Colwyn and other so-called inner ring suburbs. In spite of this enduring trend, the borough's population has dropped by nearly a fifth since 1950. It also has some pretty serious management problems.
I believe council's going in the wrong direction. This town actually is going in the wrong direction.
Paul Muser is a borough councilman. He resigned and then rescinded his resignation in November.
We actually need some help from the state as far as the Act 47 bailout.
When the state labeled Colwyn financially distressed back in May, it hired eConsult Solutions to help turn the borough around through what's called the Municipalities Financial Recovery Act, or Act 47. Stephen Mullen of eConsult said at a public meeting that the first recommendation was simply to put checks in place to encourage open and honest bookkeeping for the borough.
What's in our budget? What are we spending out of the budget? Which line items? Where do we stand relative to authorized expenditures that the borough sets up through its budget process?
Earlier this year, Colwyn racked up $1.2 million in debt, and the leadership hasn't kept coherent financial records in at least 3 years. But the borough isn't broke. Based on the records that do exist, Mullen says Colwyn takes in enough money to provide services like police and code enforcement. That money just hasn't been going where it should. The Delaware County District Attorney's Office is currently investigating the borough's finances and the fire department's for possible criminal activity. A former borough manager has also accused council members of using official funds for personal expenses.
It's like, hello, they walked in and raided the place. Everybody's lining their pockets.
This borough employee doesn't want to be named because she's afraid of losing her job for talking about corruption. She says she's not exactly surprised the state has stepped in. After all, the borough's antics are well documented.
We have been on the news so much and in the paper so much because of the discrepancies.
But whether anyone will go to jail has little to do with the state's plan to sort out Colwyn's finances. The goal of Act 47 is to put municipalities back on track to govern. On September 30th, the Borough Council approved a financial recovery plan, which included hiring a full-time administrator. Stephen Mullen from eConsult sees this as a positive step.
And the unanimous vote in Colwyn Borough, I think, is possibly the dawn of a new day where they come back in the fold of regular, well-run municipalities.
Unanimous, minus three council members and the mayor, who were no-shows. The state found that infighting played a big part in Colwyn's financial problems. In the 28 years Act 47 has existed, 11 municipalities have managed to graduate out of distressed status. For Colwyn, the question is not whether it can raise funds, but whether it can get its act together. I'm Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
The Princeton Public School District has a new policy on transgender and gender nonconforming students. The directive approved this week puts into writing what the school is doing already. But as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, backers say policies such as Princeton's are a resource for students, parents, and staff alike.
On the first page of the policy is a list of terms around gender identity, a kind of glossary for students and staff new to the topic. The policy protects students from having their transgender status disclosed, affirms their right to use the bathroom or locker room of their choice, and says they can't be discriminated against based on their gender identity. Board of Education President Andrea Spalla says it's meant less as a one-size-fits-all approach and more of a roadmap.
This is a policy about situations where nothing is really constant from case to case. And so it's a policy that tries to support the staff, respect basic principles for the students, but give everybody a lot of flexibility.
Princeton joins a growing list of districts in New Jersey and across the country looking to put more explicit policies for transgender students on the books. Aaron Potenza works for Garden State Equality, which helped write the Princeton policy. He's seen a recent spike in the number of teachers and school administrators reaching out to his group for advice on accommodating transgender students.
In the past 6 months or so, maybe a year, the hot button topic, the thing that people are interested to hear about is they have transgender students and they have questions about what to do in those situations.
The policy will affect 3,500 Princeton students at 4 elementary schools, 1 middle school, and 1 high school. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
A coalition in Delaware has formed to oppose allowing any Syrian refugees to enter the state. And it's written an open letter to Governor Jack Markell, who stated he will accept refugees with open arms. WHYY's Zoe Reed reports from the Delaware desk.
The Concerned Coalition Alliance of Delaware went to Dover to express their concerns about refugee resettlement. The alliance is a coalition of the 912 Delaware Patriots, Faith and Freedom Coalition Delaware, the NAACP of Central Delaware, and the Frederick Douglass Foundation of Sussex County. They object to Markell's comments that Delaware is only following federal guidelines. Standing in the pouring rain, Karen Gritton of 912 Delaware Patriots said the coalition is not opposed to Muslims entering the country but fear terrorists could slip in with refugees. Gritton said she believes the vetting system in the U.S. is flawed.
Importing persons from a vastly different culture and trying to integrate them is exorbitantly expensive, and the unpredictable results can be devastating.
In an email statement, Markell's office said, "The refugees we are talking about are families in desperate straits who, even given their circumstances, must wait 18 to 24 months for approval." Jacob Bender of the Philadelphia chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations said his organization is in favor of settling as many Syrian refugees as possible based on availability of sites and a vetting process.
The example set by our neighbor Canada and by Germany speak loudly of the responsibility of this country to address what the UN has described as the worst humanitarian disaster since World War II.
From the Delaware desk, I'm Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, New Jersey's Democratic-controlled Assembly again falls short in its attempt to override Governor Chris Christie's veto of legislation dealing with guns and mental illness. The Assembly vote was suspended today, falling 3 votes short of the support needed to rebuke Christie. Their final opportunity to override will be on January 11th. Thomas Jefferson University and Philadelphia University signed a letter of intent to merge today. That merger could help give Philadelphia University students a better shot at Jefferson's Medical School. Jeff would nearly double the number of its students and add to its academic programs. During a 3-year transition period, Philadelphia University's name won't change, but, quote, "eventually it will be clear it's part of Jefferson." Known for its design programs, Philadelphia University was formerly known as Philadelphia College of Textiles and Sciences. It changed its name in 1999. Overcast, 54 degrees at 6:15. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Any stray showers clearing out this evening, remaining cloudy overnight, falling back to 42 degrees. Tomorrow, overcast to start, turning partly sunny, Friday's high 50. Plenty of sunshine Saturday, but cooler, high 42 degrees, and a breeze will make it feel chillier still. Still ahead.
My name is Ebenezer Scrooge, but my friends call me Mr. Ebenezer Scrooge.
Some Christmas Carol characters make an appearance in Fairmount Park when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Wolfgang Puck is a big name in food. He's got restaurants and cookbooks, TV shows, the whole smash. But how'd he do it?
So we were really the first chefs who controlled the destiny of the restaurant. We cooked whatever we felt like, not what somebody told you, you know.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. We'll sit down for a bite with Wolfgang Puck next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Frederick Living supports WHYY. Frederick Living, a continuing care retirement community nestled in the beautiful countryside of Montgomery County, is proud to announce the expansion of their campus. The meadows at Frederick Living will consist of 55 cottages clustered in an innovative design based on the pocket neighborhood concept. Frederick Living is now taking reservations. Visits can be scheduled by calling 610-754-7878. That's 610-754-7878. Frederick Living. Live well.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro came to Philadelphia to celebrate getting homeless veterans into permanent addresses in the city. Castro says Philadelphia worked with local and federal officials to house nearly 1,400 veterans.
There's been a prudent use of resources at the federal level and at the local level. In fact, this is one of the times when Washington has actually worked the way that we would hope it would work.
Some one dozen veterans refused to be placed in housing, while 600 more chronically homeless people are still in shelters or wandering Philadelphia. Homelessness is one of five areas targeted in the Nutter administration's Shared Prosperity Plan to fight poverty. NewsWorks Tonight is looking at Mayor Nutter's legacy in several key areas affecting the city, and in this evening's fifth installment of our seven-part series, let's look at those efforts to ease poverty with Judith Levine, Associate Professor of Sociology at Temple University, and Laura Weinbaum, Vice President for Public Affairs and Strategic Initiatives at Project Home. She also serves on the board of the Homeless Advocacy Project. Judith, Laura, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Philadelphia has a reputation, and it's backed up by numbers, as having the worst poverty rate of the nation's 10 largest municipalities. Judith, was that reputation in place and backed by numbers prior to the Nutter administration?
Yes. Philadelphia has had very high poverty and deep poverty rates for many years, over 20% for the past 30 years.
So Michael Nutter takes office in 2008, and then comes the recession. The impact couldn't have been positive.
Philadelphia is interesting because compared to other cities, its spike in poverty was not as high, and it's recovered better. So some of the other top 10 cities are way up in poverty. Phoenix, for instance, its poverty rate is 32% higher than it was in 2007. New York has a rise. LA has a rise of 14%, whereas we're back almost to where we were.
The Nutter administration's efforts to stem poverty were enunciated in a five-point plan called Shared Prosperity. I'd like to speak to you specifically about the fourth item on that list, increasing housing security and affordability. What progress or lack thereof has been made over the course of these 8 years?
Housing has always been relatively inexpensive in Philadelphia. So that's the good news, and the bad news is that paired with high poverty, you also don't have hugely high costs of living in terms of housing costs. The Nutter administration created a really remarkable partnership with the Philadelphia Housing Authority, specifically looking at people who are homeless and trying to increase the flow of people who are homeless into the most permanent housing opportunities that they could find. So that has been a really huge and instrumental piece of the homelessness puzzle that has happened during the Nutter administration.
Judith, as author of Ain't No Trust, How Bosses, Boyfriends, and Bureaucrats Fail Low-Income Mothers and Why It Matters, let's talk about another point on the Nutter list, that being expanding access to public benefits and essential services. To the extent that distrust undermines policy, did the Nutter administration help to dispel distrust of the bureaucrats that the impoverished residents have to deal with?
Well, the distrust amongst low-income people is deep, but a lot of the things that the Nutter administration did are the right things to do. To have this whole section of the Shared Prosperity Plan being on increasing access to benefits was a great idea, because a lot of distrust amongst low-income people is they feel that government just wants to keep them from having benefits. And they are not wrong. federal and state governments do want to keep them from having benefits. And what the Nutter administration has done is made it much easier for them to access the benefits to which they are eligible.
So I was going to sort of piggyback on what Judith was talking about in terms of the city coming up with this Benefilly situation where they have created benefit centers in trusted community organizations. So Project Home hosts two Benefilly counselors who can help people with everything from food stamps to FAFSA, you know, your federal financial aid form, and sort of everything in between, rental rebates, low-income energy assistance programs. So people come in and they get assessed for the entire full range of benefits, whether these individuals are homeless or not.
Judith, is it even appropriate to look at it only in terms of Philadelphia, or are we so interwoven with the region, nation, and international economies that one could never put the onus on the municipality to solve the situation?
Yes. City governments have very little room to, quote, solve the poverty problem. I mean, this really comes from federal and state policy. And we as a nation are incredibly ineffective at reducing poverty. And other countries are very effective at reducing poverty. And they do it through having well-funded, universal programs. And that's something that we as a nation have resisted. So mayors can't do all that much. But with what room they have, Mayor Nutter has done several important things.
I was just going to kind of add to what Judith just mentioned, and that it's much more about the city being sort of poised to take advantage of the opportunities as they come from the federal government. And the other thing that really jumps off the page is Medicaid expansion in Pennsylvania, and that the state has now created this opportunity for the city to think creatively about how we use Medicaid to address a lot of the poverty-related, health-related issues.
Lastly, I'd like to get a sense from each of you on your reasons for optimism and realism. Are we merely the next recession away from any progress being made, being undone again?
I think there's cause for enormous optimism at the local level. I'm really excited that the new mayor really does seem to understand the intermixing of all these forces that produce poverty and hopefully some of the paths out of it. The person who, Eva Gladstein, who was overseeing shared prosperity, will now be overseeing this grand children and families space and agenda at the state level. Hopefully, once we get through this budget season, there will be some cause for real excitement about Medicaid expansion and some of the other initiatives that I know the Wolf administration holds dear.
Judith, are you in accord, or are you going to raise a cautionary note?
I think that one little caveat that Laura had is a big one. The current budget impasse gives one a little pause about the optimism. If we do get through it, it certainly is more promising than the previous state level administration that made such dire cuts, particularly to education.
Laura, Judith, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Laura Weinbaum is Vice President for Public Affairs and Strategic Initiatives at Philadelphia nonprofit Project Home. She also serves on the board of the Homeless Advocacy Project. Judith Levine is Associate Professor of Sociology at Temple University. And you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Some of the historic houses in Philadelphia's Fairmount Park are part of a Charles Dickens Christmas Carol tour. Characters from the story of Scrooge and Tiny Tim have to wait inside three colonial houses in the park for evening tours. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports from the tour bus.
The trolley leaves from the Philadelphia Museum of Art, which manages Mount Pleasant, Cedar Grove, and Lemon Hill, three 18th century homes.
Hello, welcome one and all.
This is Holly, a very chipper colonial character played by Megan Slatter. She explains that early American Christmas celebrations were nothing like today. The original Puritans looked down on revelry, such that for a short time in Boston, Christmas was illegal.
And for any of the places that did not outlaw Christmas, it was, however, a decidedly adult holiday.
18th century revelers celebrated Twelfth Night with a lot of eating, drinking, and dancing, as did Charles Dickens' character, Mr. Fezziwig, the original employer of a young Ebenezer Scrooge. At the Mount Pleasant Mansion, Mr. Fezziwig takes his trolley visitors through a dance lesson.
And go to the right. One, two, three, four. To the left. One,
the Mount Pleasant Mansion, built by a one-armed pirate in the 18th century, was considered the most elegant house in Pennsylvania. The nearby Lemon Hill Mansion was a summer retreat, unlikely to have a celebration in winter. The Cedar Grove house would not have allowed any Christmas celebrations at all because it was owned by a modest Quaker family. Site manager Justina Barrett has allowed for some poetic liberties with this holiday tour.
It's an opportunity to see them decorated for the holidays. It's an opportunity to see them at night, which is very special. But this audience wants, I think this audience wants to get their Dickens fill. And so you're really checking off two boxes with one check mark.
One of those audience members is David Eames, a big fan of Charles Dickens, who had no idea there were historic houses in Fairmount Park.
I was completely unaware of their existence or their history. I'm from Reading. You know, I don't have a lot of knowledge of that particular aspect of Philadelphia.
Just as the tour plays with history a bit, it also strays from the story of A Christmas Carol. There are no ghosts here, for example. Co-creator Brad Wren plays a reformed Scrooge after the transformation.
I do still play a curmudgeon. Instead of being this character who's down here and sort of snapping at people and being angry, but he is trying to fill his heart with love and joy.
Come in! Come in!
This Scrooge has all the right intentions, but little practice.
You see, I'm new to this whole jolly Christmas deck the halls, figgy pudding, pa-rum-pa-pum-pum, and I'm not quite sure I'm doing it all right.
The Christmas tree in Lemon Hill Mansion will not light up until sufficient Christmas spirit fills the room.
I don't think it's me. I think it's one of you guys.
While historic house tours have been offered for 45 years, this is only the second year of these evening tours with actors. The Art Museum is still finding its feet.
Keep it going.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. The Philadelphia Housing Authority is slowly replacing high-rise projects with less dense townhomes, but that's created a huge backlog to get into subsidized housing. We'll explore the issue on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Supporting WHYY, Moore College of Art and Design offers career change part-time evening programs for adult men and women at their convenient Center City campus. Students can create new options for their future by earning a professional certificate in interior design, print and web design, motion graphics, fashion design, or fashion merchandising. Now registering for winter courses beginning Monday, January 25th. Further details at moore.edu or 215-965-4030.
The attack on the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Colorado Springs is an example of the dangers faced at clinics providing abortions. The threats and violence follow many abortion providers into their homes. On the next Fresh Air, David Cohen and Kristen Conan talk about their book, Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM. Natural Lands Trust supports WHYY. For more than 60 years, Natural Lands Trust has been preserving open spaces in our region so people and nature can thrive. Information about how your support for Natural Lands Trust can keep our communities green and details about nature preserves to visit are available at natlands.org. Natural Lands Trust, land for life.